You know, the other thing is that, so Crowley kind of was around when the I Ching was first kind of coming back to the West or being rediscovered by the West or...
Did you read that was his feeling was that that was the most important thing that he's ever done in his work?
The translation?
Was his work with the I Ching, was finding the synchronicity, literally,
that's...
between the I Ching and tarot.
Okay, perfect. So that kind of... This is the thing, too, is that when you get involved with this shit and this work, these mega synchronicity, it's like detective stories. And I'm sure the energy produced with him discovering the I Ching, working with it, and then finding how it fit perfectly into the tarot, I mean, that's worth the price of admission alone, is that kind of illumination. Because... for a guy who's read everything, or read everything possible, traveled throughout the lands, seen so many things, and then to see something new, to discover something new, mm-hmm. that is, you know, that's the goal, seemingly, is to bring something back, is to fit something together, bring it back, so other people can and look at it and go, that makes sense. I only mention that because it just makes sense that McKenna's work with the I Ching and taking it a next step, he was just reproducing the same kind of thing that Crowley was doing, except he was mapping the I Ching to something a little bit more majestic, maybe less, but mapping it to time. It's weird. We're a month away from this magical date on our calendar. For me...
Yeah, I'm wondering... how many people are aware that who we have to thank for that other than Jose Arguelles and the synchronicity between him and Terence McKenna. Terence McKenna comes to this date, discovers Jose Arguelles' work, sees that they came to it through entirely different means, almost like a Krishnamurti, David Bohm kind of difference.
The Crick discovery of the double helix. Or no, I'm thinking evolution. Darwin came up with evolution, and a guy in a fever dream came up with evolution, right?
Yeah, the guy who came up with the double helix was on LSD at the time, which is something that I forgot to include in my... There's a number of things I forgot to include in my chapter that are little gems. And I'm like, what's so significant about the discovery of LSD, like, other than in terms of, like, you know, culturally, like, what that meant in terms of our self-expression? Like, it's like, dude, the fucking double helix was discovered on LSD. Like, that should be common knowledge. Like, that was like, that served a real function. And then you have, obviously, you know, everything that's come out of that. Double helix is a really big deal, you know, in terms of our insight. You recognize that the foundation of our structure is basically serpentine. And its design, you know, it's like the Caduceus.
Yeah,
Caduceus,
that's, you know. Yeah, that's just disturbed because you read Crowley and he's flirting with all these ideas in his poetry and some of his, you know, more dramatic phrases.
Mm-hmm.
But you were saying like Krishnamurti and David Bohm with quantum physics.
Mm-hmm. Well, he didn't really... David Bohm... isn't working, like, when you say quantum physics, his approach to it is much different. It's not just that it's peer-reviewed, I consider his work, his idea of the implicit order and whatnot to be more of value than I consider a lot of the work in quantum physics, because it seems like a lot of quantum physics is kind of almost like beating around the bush, like it doesn't want to face some of, like, the core things that were pointed out by Einstein, whereas, like, David Bohm's work doesn't feel that way. It feels like he's actually confronting some of that, you know, in terms of unified field theory, that some people would like to avoid. You know, they don't know how to approach an abyss, basically.
I wrote an essay on, not to take it back a step, to back to Serious Man. I wrote a blog entry on that movie comparing... Okay. What'd you think of that?
It's great.
with Larry and Arthur, you know, and they're two
by the pool, and it says not divine or whatever, yeah. No diving, but you yeah. were like no divine or whatever. I like that. I could see that for yeah. sure. He's denying God, and then here you have like, you know, it's, yeah.
Well, and it's just that Arthur's Mentaculus is Finnegan's Wake. It's just he has no authority. He has no one to say, proof this man is a genius. Look, mm-hmm. he's created Ulysses, and now he's created Finnegan's. I mean, there's no one there to actually make sense of what he's communicated in that book. And Larry is teaching on the chalkboard Schrodinger's cat. You know, he's teaching, he's supposedly knows what he's teaching, or is he just going through the motions? And,
right.
But, you know, the whole thing is that the hidden variable in quantum physics, which they're trying to find at CERN, which mm-hmm. is the Higgs boson, right? The thing that will tie up and once and for all solve or prove all these theories. I guess that's just the first grader's approach to quantum physics. But mm-hmm. But it's like trying to find the definitive story in Finnegan's Wake. To basically say, what is the hidden variable in Finnegan's Wake, or what is the hidden variable in the Mentaculus? What does it mean? Well, you'll never find it. You just won't. Mm-hmm. It's like the whole Talmudic notion that time flows through this writing. And as it flows through time, it changes and it reflects where it is in time. It's alive because it organically adapts to its place in space and time. And to try to define it as something static is to kill it.
Right.
And if you yeah. killed it,
I mean, Einstein found his variable that he didn't know how to work around, even though they were basically still able to use the equations despite the fact that he hit a nasty infinity, meaning an unreconcilable infinity, which is basically a black hole. So he hits this in the middle of the equation, is unable to reconcile it, and it basically, like, this other guy, I don't know, was it, what's his name? Schwartzman? Or no, not Schwartzman, what's fucking... Can't remember the physicist's name, but basically somebody else in... trying to sound like I know what I'm talking about, but I know what's important in what I'm talking about. I can't remember the guy's name or where he was from, but whatever. This other guy, Rothschild, continues on with the work and basically uses the equation while ignoring, essentially, nasty infinity. So he's like, okay, this is here, but let's just see what happens if we continue it. And so they were still able to use it. And the implications of that are really interesting. Because it's like, okay, in the middle of this equation, there's something unreconcilable, but we go ahead and we use it anyway. Let's ignore what that means and just whatever. Like, it's like this thing. And so, like, that was Einstein's feeling, was that he was like, with everything I have here, there should be no reason why this isn't enough. So what's the problem? And so, like, so you can see, like, with a lot of what's happened with quantum theory is they've just kind of continued on, and they go down tangents and they go in all these different directions. And a lot of people just want to make names for themselves, and you have to keep going if you want to make a name for yourself. You can't be like, okay, well, this is it, you know. But I mean, a black hole, I mean, that's like, those exist, or for lack of a better word, in order for something to exist, it literally has to stand out. In fact, if you like look up exist in the dictionary, that's just what it says, to stand out in space, you know. And so you're like, oh, black holes exist. No, they don't. You know, but it's like, there's places in the galaxy where you have groups of black holes that are just so enormous, and we don't really know what they are. They're just fucking there. And like, Ophiuchus, that was something I wrote about in my chapter. There's more black holes centered in Ophiuchus than we know of, like, anywhere. So at the constellation of the Serpent Bearer, you have, like, the most centralized place of black holes, which is fucking far out, you know?
How come Ophiuchus is not in the traditional zodiac and astrology?
What's that?
How come Ophiuchus is not an astrological sign in the zodiac for like birth?
Right. Well, there's different opinions on that, but it crosses the line with the other 12 signs, and so that's a really good question. My feeling is that a big part of it is just that it's a lot easier to work with an even number if you're making a natal chart. So if you're working with just a standard chart, you don't want to divide something up by an uneven number. It's like try and draw the septagram, you know.
Why we have 12 months in a year instead of the 13 lunar? Right?
The months are something else too. I mean, it could just be totally symbolic, you know. I mean, that you the 12 is like an important number, you know.
The
like,
disciples, the 13th being JC, that.
Yeah, and if you're working with geometry, you know, it's much easier to work with 12. It's 6 times 2. Like, you can...
Yeah. Like, conveniences when you're talking about cosmic forces that shape our psychologies and personalities. And, I mean, maybe I'm... See, a huge blind spot in my studies is I just haven't spent the time with astrology, which is probably a... very damning admission. I should, obviously. It's a language and alphabet that is essential.
Even about the signs. Like, you can't, like, they're different. They take up different portions, and each bleeds into the next. And we project this, like, you know, like with mathematics and with the design of it, we're projecting a perfection that isn't there. Signs bleed into each other, and they're almost like they're practically like malleable. So you can't do this thing that we're doing. We're treating the stars as if we were like building a car or a house. You know what I mean? Like, we want everything to be perfect, and it's not that way. And so, like, and it's, we're like, oh, do we include this sign? Oh, but that'll throw everything off. It's like, well, fuck, you know?
So would the lower Shekinah be an attempt to achieve perfection, to want to approach some standardization, whereas the higher Shekinah knows and exists in that turning?
That's an interesting idea. I mean, basically, the lower Shekinah is the higher Shekinah in a state of exile. And so, and then that's what splits apart the tree, which wants to be reunited. She's the feminine side of the tree, and all she does is receive. It's like the earth, like you can pollute the planet, and all it does is just takes it all in like a sponge. And so this is the thing, like, okay, I had an ayahuasca experience where I saw the serpents as, not as the drug, which most people do, although people would say medicine would be the appropriate way to put this, right? But they see it as a serpentine thing. And you look at the actual root or branch or whatever, and it looks like a caduceus, the way it twists, you know? But it felt like... okay, I went through this whole thing around this, and I brought it up to my rabbi for feedback, and it was extremely affirming, because he proceeded to pull out different books and show me stuff about Draco and all this stuff, the idea of the pole star and Draco connecting with our planet, and like I was explaining to him, like, if you look at a picture of the UN symbol of the Earth, you're looking at as if you're looking from Draco at the planet, which is just far out. And then there's this whole Kabbalistic thing around that they've talked about in relationship to the Zohar. It's a very big issue, the serpent in terms of Draco. But anyways, I was like looking at these, at the pathways, like as if they were the tree, the pathways of the tree, like with lines of force that were running through them that were like serpents. And they were like embedded in the material reality. So like I was talking about this last week, but this is like huge. So they're like basically like holding together our perception of the world. They're like these lines of force basically. And the only reason I say serpent is because that's the closest way it seems that the mind has to communicate whatever this is, this phenomenon that's like mercurial, like lines of attachment. And so it's like holding this whole constitution together that dictates our perceptions. Our perceptions are in consensus agreement. This is our reality. What's keeping it that way? Because it's in our mind, right? Like, there might be an objective reality beyond, but what is this thing that keeps these beliefs together? And so it felt like that there's an inertia to that, so that, you know, something's moving in a straight line, nothing's going to deviate its force unless it's acted upon by some directional force from outside. And it seemed like ayahuasca was that directional force. Like, it was enough to disrupt their, like, holding on the thing. And so the reason why it felt like an exorcism was because these things that are so held, like, retracted and, like, recoiled and were like, like, fuck you. Like, it was like they didn't want to let go because they're like, but when they were retracting, everything became malleable. So you could make shifts and just total freedom in terms of perception. But it was all, like, through whatever I wanted. So it was like, if I wanted to see it this way, it would become that way instantaneously. So, like, and it was, it didn't feel in the same way I felt with other psychedelics, like a hallucination, because I was in touch with the fact that, I mean, I'm always in touch with the fact that it's my imagination, but this was like a whole other level because of how willing it was to work with what I wanted to see. Like, I was very aware of how I imagine this, and as I'm imagining it, it comes to be. But basically, I was looking at these serpents that were pre-existing in the first place in the same way as, like, snot. So, you know, like, snot in your body starts out pure and it's white, it's like clear, and it descends into your body and it absorbs toxins and it takes everything into itself, and then it comes out and you purge it. You spit it out and it's all like, oh, that looks gnarly, and people are like, oh, snot's gross. It's like, snot's not gross. The fucking toxins in your body that snot absorbs are gross. There's a big difference here. And so the serpents, or whatever, you know, I call it that, but whatever it is, were like that. These lines of force that attach themselves start out pure. And so this is like, I was considering, Numbers 21, which was on the first coins that referred to as dollar, you know, where you have Nechash, you have the serpent on one side, then you have the Messiah on the other, which have the same geometrical value, which is 3, 5, 8, which is the third, fourth, and fifth numbers of the Fibonacci sequence. You know, you have, and then the tree itself, the lightning flash, is taken as the Fibonacci sequence because fucking lightning is Fibonacci sequence. The tree of life is the Fibonacci sequence. The lines of force are the Fibonacci. So that's how they branch apart, and that was what my experience was, and that they're basically have these lines running through them that are like serpents. And so I was like, they basically absorb all the toxins, or whatever you want to call it, that's actually ultimately part of themselves, and then they try and turn around and return to the light. And that is ambition, and that is like, wow, everything. Like, Jesus. Nationalism, that's corporations, that's all of it, trying to get back to the source. And so that's why it's a pyramid, like, because they're like, basically they descend out in all directions, and then when they try to come back, they can't reach the Ein Sof again. As they are, they have to be purified. And that's why in Hebrew, the word for salvation or the word for redemption is the same word for vomiting. It means to throw up. And so I was tripping out on the fact that, like, I mean, I went all night. I drank it. And then I threw up at one point, I don't know, it was like 3 a.m. or something, but I was last one to throw up in this group of people, like, you know, in the course of the thing, because, like, it was like the sun had come up, I was laying there, and all of a sudden, it just, like, I felt hot all over in a matter of seconds. I'm just, like, hot, and it all purged out, and I was like, you know? Yeah. But it was that I could see that it was just absorbing everything and then it wanted to come out. But that was something that, I mean, it was like, it was something that was sent in order to disrupt. But what it was not much different ultimately from what was already there, which is very strange, very much like a rebirthing process, you know.
It's weird because I was listening to a McKenna lecture about tryptamine. It's called tryptamine consciousness, and he's saying that the tryptamine hallucinogens are DMT, ayahuasca, and psilocybin. That is, those three are in that kind of experience. So, not having had the chance to do ayahuasca, I haven't had the chance to do DMT, though by all accounts and reports, it seems to me that salvia might just be a close cousin, whatever. But that vomiting, that purging experience, I've had on psilocybin. Mm-hmm. And it is unforgettable, especially with your with the toxins thing, is because I felt that I was vomiting out the tar and resin of every cigarette I had ever smoked when that happened. That I was going through this enlightening, purifying experience, and now it said, it was like tapping me on the shoulder and says, all right, now we need to discuss the poison that you put in your body. Now we're going to inject the poison, and I want you to recognize that you put this inside of yourself, and this is not going to be pleasant, but we have to go through this. And it was like I vomited from like the center of my testicles all the way up my stomach, and it was the most violent, and I could be there if I just closed my eyes in a second. And I have to say that it was that experience that helped me eventually quit smoking, is that I could tap into that feeling. And I don't know, because it wasn't like I vomited out like a year's worth of tar and poison. Mm-hmm. It felt like I vomited out centuries worth of tar and poison.
Yeah.
And I took it to heart as something that wasn't, it announced itself and erupted out of the experience as the most real part of the entire experience. It was why I, like the beauty and the magic and everything was just sort of to get me inside the door so I could go through this event.
Mm-hmm.
That if the medicine announced itself with that first, then no one would ever do it. That right. No one would ever continue to even consider it a party drug or consider it a good time or consider it, you know, the carnival that people on the surface believe it to be. But for whatever reason, that was an experience that I had and I never forget. And to hear you describe it and to hear that it's described so poetically and so exactly in the texts that your rabbi understands.
Right. I mean, they're not talking, they don't say it's, they're talking about ayahuasca, but because I think that that basically ayahuasca is if you go through an initiatory process and what's required of you is like the same thing, and it's an intensification of it, with the substance is just like an accelerator on something that like wants to happen. And I think it's also, there's something that plays into it in terms of it, and intention goes a long way. So what you intend to experience and how you're relating to the thing, what you're asking for it, it wants to give it to you. It's there to assist. But if you want something different, it'll try and help you. It'll try and assist in that. And so, you know, and then there's also like levels of like, if you're resisting certain things that it's trying to show you, all it does is show them to you harder. It's like it doesn't hold back.
Not for a second.
Right. So I don't know. I think that the nausea and the purging play a key role. Tobacco is actually considered the sister plant of ayahuasca, and so the tobacco plays a part in the ceremony. And so I hadn't smoked in, I believe, over 2 years, and I smoked for years. And I had a cigarette that night after hours into it, you know, and it was like relating to the thing on a whole different level. And I know I'm not going to continue to smoke, like, because it was not, I wasn't seeing the thing as I had seen it in the past. It was like through a whole different set of eyes, you know? And so, yeah, it's extremely, extremely healing experience. And so there was nothing recreational about it. There's nothing fun about it. And that was not its purpose, and that was understood. It's like you're also it's a group experience too. Though it's a personal experience on one level, you're in it with the group, and you can feel connected with everyone in the room in more of a direct way.
Well, don't they
more of a direct way than a normal consciousness? You're aware of them.
McKenna, you know, whatever. I source McKenna. I trust McKenna as a source, and if it's bullshit, it's bullshit. Whatever. He talks about a scientist who first I think it was ayahuasca that these German scientists were studying, but they referred to the active ingredient as telepathine.
Mm-hmm.
That because
telepathy
of telepathine, like a chemical.
Telepathine.
Yeah. And that's the nature of the group ceremony with ayahuasca, is that everyone is logging on to each other through this brew. And, you know, if that's what they named it, it's a pretty powerful name. I mean, that's mm-hmm. not just psychedelic has just, it's because language is just so malleable. Mm-hmm. I mean, it gets the nature of telepathy gets lost in psychedelics. Psychedelic seems like chaos, seems like just disordered noise. But telepathine seems crisp and seems focused and seems laser-like, and you kind of understand what you would be getting into. And I've had experiences of that telepathic awareness, and it could be hallucination, but I imagine if you're in a den with 8 people, you have plenty of time to figure out whether or not it's hallucination or it's really happening. Mm-hmm. So I, from what I'm gathering, you did a traditional ayahuasca ceremony with 8, well, how many people in your group?
Relatively traditional. I mean, it could be more traditional. There was no shaman in the traditional sense. I mean, there was song all night that were, some of it was traditional songs. Most of it was traditional songs. But, I mean, I have a friend who went to Peru, you know, a very close friend of mine, and she did a traditional experience. You know, this wasn't that. But this was intentional. I think that there was, there's a lot of people in the group, probably, maybe 15, something like that.
See, the whole nature of 15, were you outside?
No, it was inside.
Yeah. Was it a dark room, or were there candles, or?
It was completely dark.
Completely yeah. dark. But did you have sort of visual awareness of your environment during the experience?
Not much.
Not much. It's weird that ayahuasca is now bubbling into the mainstream, and it's sort of like, it seems to be reported that people with money are flying down to the Amazon to go to almost like ayahuasca resorts. Do you think that's a good thing? Do you think that put your faith in the plant, that doesn't matter how people come to it, if they're coming to it, then they're bringing back the heal?
It's its own intelligence, and it does what it's designed to do. I wouldn't be worried about that. I mean, people come from all kinds of places, and if they have the intention to
how is LSD
heal,
different?
Know, they get that.
How is LSD?
And if they
different?
Have other intentions, everything's very, you know, you get reflections back to you very quickly. It knows what it's doing. I trust it.
So how is LSD different from that? Did people get the message in the 60s, or did people miss it? Or did, I mean, it seemingly some people got
you
it?
You can't make a generalization with, I mean, LSD is everything all at once. And yes, there's levels of reflection, but it is an it's not in the same way. It doesn't force as much of a healing. If you set out with the intention to heal, it assists. I felt that ayahuasca didn't really mess around as much. It was very directed. It knew where it needed to go, and it went there, and it pulled out what it needed to, or what needed to be pulled out. I felt like that was it. It was aware of what it was doing. That's to say, LSD takes all the neurological connections and just leaves everything open. This was like pulled back the connections, but showed their different levels of resistances in a way that I hadn't really experienced before. So they turn back and hiss at you, basically. Or at least they did, and that was my experience. It was like their face was shown on a level that it had not. Everything about it was completely familiar. It did not feel like I took anything new. It felt like a space that I had been before. It felt like it was extremely easy to call back literally memories of early childhood, at least energetically. And the visuals that came with it were of my own imagination. Any voices I heard were of my own imagination, my own ability to project, which is vaster than I think we usually consider. But the energetic experience was all too familiar. It was like when I was a blind cave fish, basically, which I was, it like brought that up again.
Brought that up again. Would you say, though, that to me it would seem that the mushroom, and I'm assuming from your experiences, ayahuasca, because it's plant-based, mm-hmm. It has a more affinity for the body, or for, you know how, okay, the heart chakra, or the heart, the center of the heart, and people talk about living with the heart, listening to the heart. I kind of connect that terminology as basically just the entire human body. That
sure.
Okay, so you include brain, you include guts, you include genital, you include skin. To say heart is a fabrication. It's just body. More
right.
Accurately.
You're aware of the HeartMath Institute and some of the work that they're doing. That's actually local to here, but they're like HeartMath. There's people that have run with some of their speculations and have, like, totally, like, there's a film called I Am or whatever, and it's just, like, there's a lot of bogus information there, but they're doing real work. Basically, the electromagnetic field that's produced in terms of the heart is greater than that of the brain, which is suggestive of emotional intelligence. So this is actually like my girlfriend did her thesis, but her dissertation on basically wife batterers and emotional intelligence. And so she did a lot of research in emotional intelligence. And this is one of the things that came out that's a matter of fact, is that the field of the heart is actually much greater than that of the brain. And so there's something interesting there. It's also the way that they actually represent it because of their findings, is the double torus. The torus itself, the donut, the spiraling donut, that's how they see the electromagnetic field of the heart and the brain. And that they meet, they basically cross paths and they intersect and they interrelate. And there's actually a distinction but no separation between these in a single human being. And there's a distinction, there's no separation between yours and anyone around you and anyone across the globe. And that the Earth itself has its own version of that, which is a giant electromagnetic field, which we're all extensions of. And it's just super simple, you know, easy to go crystal hippie with it. but at the same time, there's some truth to it. And so that's really interesting.
So do you think that these plant-based medicines affect that center more intimately, that they harmonize better? They affect, like, I didn't never threw up on LSD. I never had that rumbling, that earthquake of awareness and physical sensation that preceded the vomiting or the purging. I never even approached that with the chemical LSD. Now, I don't know if that's simply because it's so distilled that it's actually just this little tiny square. It's just this hair's breadth of liquid.
Not even a square, because that square is just, I mean, it's like...
Yeah, so, but is it, I mean, am I confusing just sheer biology in that, you know, you dump, you know, a handful of dried plant matter and put it into your body, or you drink this brew that I'm just confusing biology with something metaphysical.
I don't know. It's not nausea producing, you know. I mean, and it's not just sheer amount either. I mean, mescaline does the same thing. Mescaline, I could actually probably relate to ayahuasca more than just about anything else. Or at least that's been my experience. I feel like both are.
But see, mescaline is in itself a distilled product. That's a man-made laboratory chemical.
What's that?
Mescaline.
Oh. No.
Because that's extracted from peyote.
Right, but your extraction processes can be completely natural. You can eat the peyote directly.
Or
if you have San Pedro, you basically you cut the skin, just the outer edge, and then you ideally freeze it so that when you put it in the blender, it'll shrapnelize a little bit.
But
maybe I shouldn't be describing this.
You know what I'm saying, though? I'm just saying that there seems to be something is altered. If you eat peyote, if someone said, I ate peyote, and someone said, I had mescaline, do you think that they would have the same experience? It seems to me that peyote...
You might be thinking of some of the later parts of the process that are still not... I mean, maybe there's something you can do in a laboratory in order to make the concoction like liquid based or something, but you don't have to do that.
I guess I'm trying to sort of like with peyote going into it, people will tell you there's a very good chance you're going to vomit.
Oh yeah.
Okay. That it's part of going through this initiation where you have, let's say a blotter, a piece of acid or whatever, they wouldn't give you that warning because it's not common to the experience. Mm-hmm. Going in, if someone says, I hope you don't like vomiting violently because it's a very good possibility this will happen with this LSD. No one tells you that. Mm-hmm. But they tell you that with peyote. And I think people would almost, would you feel that it was sort of not polite to tell people before they took peyote, just sort of like, hey, it's going to happen anyways. There's no point in telling them. I guess just to not ramble, it's like there's a part of the experience that is unpleasant, most explicitly in the peyote experience. It's going to, before you get into that, you break open into the pleasant part, you're going to have to process these buttons in your stomach, and there's going to be a violent exchange there.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that it's the initiation, it's the hazing, it's the basic training. It's you need to go through that. It's part of it. It's part of the medicine. Whereas a lot of Western medicine seems to want to cut that out, to where you have a sacrament in a Catholic church where they give you supposedly the body and blood of Christ, and it does absolutely nothing.
Right. The pills Mother gives you don't do anything at all.
It doesn't do a fucking thing. And if they did, if the blood and body of Christ that these magical priests in their robes consecrate, and they tell you we take regular wine and regular bread and we turn them into these the body and blood of our Savior, if they actually affected that change, well, then people would be going, like, that substance would be under lock and key.
Right, those supposedly that used to be Amanita muscaria, so whatever.
Those priests would be, you wouldn't want to fuck around with those motherfuckers, because if you could change regular wine and bread into something that did what peyote did, or did what ayahuasca did, those would be, just by chanting words over it, those would be some heavy motherfuckers. I mean, the game would be completely changed. But essentially right. What has happened is that they've just extracted everything physical out of it, took it into just purely faith-based through song and pageantry and print and almost brainwashing you into it from a very, very early age. They've taken the substance out of the thing. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder if, you know, underground culture going from marijuana, peyote, and these plant-based brews into, you know, pot that doesn't give you paranoia and ecstasy, which isn't psychological, it's just all emotion, that it's sort of following, it's skipping around the hazing or the initiation. It's skipping around the guts and the purification of the matter. And I don't know if that, I don't know really how to process that or make judgment on that, if it's a good, a bad, or if it's anything at all. But I'm sensing that there's a trend there that who sucked out the
people
feeling?
Don't want healing, they want pleasure.
Yes.
Like, yeah, no, totally.
That's what those mega churches are, you know? It's how do we get people to get the feeling of seeing Bruce Springsteen in concert, but take away all the danger and all the, sort of rebellion. Well, get a church full of 12,000 people. Half of the thing about going to an arena show that's so exciting and turns you on and makes you think of, that is one of the greatest things I've ever seen in my life, is just to be in a room full of 12,000 excited human beings.
Sure.
It's an environment that is rare, and you don't come across it.
Right. So people don't realize, like, that's a big issue, is that, like, people have this experience if they go to a mega church or if they go to church in general, and they experience a religious fervor, that they're making, first of all, they're in this environment, there's all these people, they're in agreement with the people around them, they feel united through that consensus agreement, and they feel excited. Their adrenaline goes, they got their cortisol, they're high, okay, from the situation. And then they're being told, this is why, this is why, this is why, and they connect it with that. And then they feel distance from people who get it from other means. So, you know, so-and-so goes to a fucking rock concert, feels connected with everyone around them, feels this excitement. They equate it with that. They're like, oh man, do you know what Tool just did for me? Like, that was a fucking Tool concert, and they're equating it with this thing. And they're like, no, I went to church, and it was Jesus. It was the power of Jesus. He was in me. And it was like, dude, Maynard was fucking in me last night, man. It's like, do you realize? Like, it's the first of all, the description's not the described, and the observer is the observed. So, like, everyone's, like, part of this thing, and there's no point where they end and their neighbor begins in actuality, and they're affirming it on some level, but then they're also simultaneously, out of whatever reason, because of the nature of our ego autonomy as a fear-based structure, they use that group that they feel so connected to separate them from the rest of the world. So they're united as this. So, like, we, in as the United States, on a patriotic level, do the same thing, because we're like, we're united as this. We're separate, but united at the same time. So you can maintain the separation, but still feel that you're connected. And how do you do that? By being connected to the people around you, and you're united in a common cause, which is against these people's cause. And so that's the way that the whole thing plays out, and that's the nature of a demon. you're united in this thing that's separating itself from the source. So you're distancing yourself from one thing, and you're connecting to it on another level.
And this purifying and this sort of sterilizing of this sort of engine that a mega church or a rock concert is, you can see it by the lack of glossolalia and religious ecstasy of shouting. I mean, a lot of white bread mega churches, I don't think necessarily condone those kinds of immediate expressions of religious insight within the confines of a typical service. No one's going to just start speaking in tongues at a regular church service without someone shepherding that person out of the environment. Yeah. Or someone just sort of being filled with the light and testifying in the middle of a sermon by a priest while it's being televised, they're going to say, hey, get that person out of here, because it's conflicting with the other kind of direction of the service.
And yeah, it makes you start vomiting up cherry pits, you know, that usually doesn't fly very well. As symbolic as it might be of the pop cherry in the garden, you know, you're vomiting cherry pits. That's you know,
clean up in aisle 23.
You're out. Yeah, you're getting escorted out of the room.
And it makes me think of how when you go to most rock concerts nowadays, the mosh pit is, for the most part, been eliminated for insurance reasons. You know. Just for my example, in Chicago, there's a club, the Metro, where I saw a lot of great shows, and there's signs, no moshing. And how do you remove that from a concert? A, you're just assuming that a mosh pit is going to happen, which is right there kills the whole point of it. The music is supposed to generate the energy that allows that sort of thing to start whirling and then happen. But when you say, when you just assume that it's going to happen, you assume that it's false, and then when you don't allow it, you're stifling an energy. There's a castration of that church when you don't allow that. When you don't allow smoking at a concert. When you have all ages shows, it's like they've allowed rock to continue, but they've cut out very essential elements of it that allow the transformation to take place on a very personal and individualistic level. I think of that term, the mikveh, the bathtub, you know, where all the chemicals are simmering, and I think I'm getting that concept right, of the bathtub, where it's sort of the bottom of the tree, where everything is filtered down, and it's the furthest point away from the supernal triad, you know. But it's where
Malkut. You're talking about the base of the Malkut being, yes, the funneling.
Yeah, that it's the blood and the sweat and the jism and the broken bones. It's like the just most basic elemental toxins of the tree that,
sure,
simmer at the bottom.
Yeah, yeah. If you look at the film The Fountain, you'll see that when he looks into the future and he's in the spherot moving up, I mean, whatever, spherot doesn't literally come from sphere, it comes from sapphire. Sapphire and spherot are the same thing. But as he's moving up through space to the dying star, that's the supernal realm. That's the supernal side of the tree. When he's in the past and he's a conquistador and he's taking over this Mayan ruin thing and he's searching out the tree on that level, that is Malkuth. And so the point at which he eats of the tree and dissolves into density of nature, that's what you're speaking to. That's like, it's saying that there's no way around this. It's the point of that film is that if you go in this direction from the most astute to the most like, you know, you're taking the practice and intention as far as you can and doing everything, you're hitting every mark. You go to more and more etheric levels and you find an eternity on that level. If you fuck up and you kill and you just, you know, do everything, you know, but you still have ambition, you know, you find the same truth, but on a completely different level. So that the roots are its branches when it comes to the tree of life, and the thing actually folds into itself. And so there's no escaping this. Your soul is going to be reconciled no matter what direction you go. And then in the middle, he's just reconciling the death of his wife, which is he has to reconcile his own relationship to life in that. And that's mm-hmm. why there's the seed, and it's a super Kabbalistic film, ultra Kabbalistic film. But that's that same idea of that you have the shit at the bottom, which is what I was talking about the serpents descend, you know, the line descends 777 in the European yeah. system. And then here, you know, it absorbs all the toxins and it can either just thrive and exist within that, like a lot of people do, or it can try and ambitiously get back and it'll end up experiencing what happens with that because you can't go back unpurified. Or, you know, you go through and you die basically in that, and then it still gets liberated.
Well, that's sort of like the mosh pit. Right? I mean, when you see it from the outside, you're like, there's no fucking way I'm even going in there. It's violent. It's chaotic. There's no way a sane person says, let me just move 20 feet over into the middle of that fucking mess. But yeah. if you get uplifted by the energy of the room, whether it's being supplied by a rock band or a priest or whatever it is, you find yourself in there. And when you're in there, you can either be crushed to death. I mean, it's just a very real possibility. It's not very safe. But you also find that your identity dissolves. You mm-hmm. just become one with the energy. And in my experience, it's a sort of like a mosh pit cliche, is that I remember falling down and being on my back in the middle of this, thinking, I'm going to get fucked up here. And then out of nowhere, an arm just pulled me out and saved me. Mm-hmm. And I've seen it happen, you know, many times. And then it happened to me. And there was this purifying nature that it gave me some trust that even in the darkest moment, someone saw me. Someone saw my vulnerability and extracted me. And mm-hmm. that's sort of that purification of that vomiting, that like dread and death and all the darkest things descended upon me and consumed me, but there was something other there to help out. And it was just a very illuminating experience, and it was an initiatory type experience. And if kids aren't getting that at rock concerts nowadays due to restrictions based on insurance and venues not allowing moshing, well, then where are they getting it? Because they're mm-hmm. going to search it out somewhere. They're not getting it in video games. They're not getting it online on computers. Where are they getting that visceral, physical, initiatory experience?
Right. Well, that's the thing, right? I mean, the initiation used to be in Africa. I think I've brought this up before, but you had to fucking kill a motherfucking lion, like, at the age of, like, whatever, 13, you know, there's where the teenager doesn't exist, you know, it's just that you just, in our eyes, you happen to be 13, but you have to go out there with a fucking stick that's sharp and kill a lion. You have to know how to get the stance for when it jumps on you to have the stick go through. Like, that's an initiation that, like, you know, males had to do. Like, in some places, still do, I'm sure. And, like, that's, like, we have no, what do we do? We do drugs. But then when the drugs that we're taking are trying to get around this essential part of what traditionally has been key, which is purging. And even if you're not vomiting, you still, like, you have to set the intention to purge what you no longer want in your life and which doesn't serve your higher understanding, not in any moralistic projected sense, but in, like, an actual, like, what serves and what fucking doesn't. What do I want to shed? And if you say you have nothing that you want to shed, then you can know right away, whoever the fuck you are, that you're full of shit. You know?
Yeah. It's, I mean, the typical thing in the 60s with the Harvard boys and the alcoholism project, you know, and how psilocybin was helping people gain, it wasn't curing them of a disease, it was opening their eyes to their behaviors and opening their eyes to how others perceive them. So maybe that is the disease itself. It just manifested in alcoholism. But it was actually changing habitual habits within those realms. I don't know why that shit never affixed itself to the medical community. But therein lies, you know, your whole conspiratorial genesis as to why it's sort of kept quiet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I gotta press pause on the recording, but yeah, I'll be back in a bit.
Okay.